May it please the court, counsel. This case is, there are two issues in this case. One is whether the Rule 11 violation affected the defendant's substantial rights, and the second issue is whether the consecutive sentences violated the double jeopardy clause. The defendant, Tracy Parker, pled guilty to attempt to escape, as well as conspiracy to escape, to attempt to escape, to aid the escape, and to aid the attempted escape. He pled guilty without a plea agreement, and the district court engaged in a colloquy pursuant to Rule 11. The district court went over a number of the areas required, but when he got to the sentencing guidelines, he discussed how the sentencing guidelines are calculated and the fact that this sentence would be consecutive to the sentence the defendant was already serving, and then asked the defense attorney about expectations for a downward departure. When he heard that there were no such expectations, he then proceeded to discuss the sentence as that he stated would be within the guidelines. And although no specific sentence was mentioned, the judge mentioned several times, in fact, six times I believe I counted, the term within the guidelines, that the sentence would be within the guidelines. In fact, at one point the judge said, I promise you your sentence will be within the guidelines. Now, the term within the guidelines is used in a very specific way, and it means within the sentencing guideline range that is determined without going into any departures. And it's been used that way by the Sentencing Commission, by in a congressional report, in case law. If a prosecutor had made the same promise of a sentence within the guidelines and then proceeded to request an upward departure, this would be a clear case of breach. So the judge's promise that the defendant would receive a sentence within the sentencing guidelines affected the defendant's ability to understand and evaluate the direct consequences of his guilty plea, and therefore it affected his substantial rights, and thus the error is plain. The upward departure netted him a sentence of 96 months, which was more than twice the high end of what his sentencing guideline range would have been as determined. Since he was at level 14 at the criminal history category 6, and the range was 37 to 46 months. This was far more than just a failure to advise of the possibility of an upward departure. The defendant had been sentenced previously in another case where he had pled guilty, and he had been advised at that time that there was a possibility of an upward departure, but here the judge's promise of a sentence within the guidelines negated the presumption that he would have to recall something that went on in a prior case.
Of course, the defendant did have some awareness of an upward departure potential, I think, with the pre-sentence report and the government's position. Isn't that true? I understand that the judge used the term within, but it was in the atmosphere, so to speak.
That's correct, and the defendant's counsel argued in opposition to that, maintaining that that couldn't be done.
Couldn't be done.
Well, both. But one of his arguments was that there could be no consecutive sentences, mm-hmm. and so even if there was this thing out there, the defendant could not have contemplated that he would have gotten more than 5 years. In fact, at one point where the judge is discussing the sentencing guidelines, he says, that I will listen to recommendations of counsel on both sides, but I don't have to take their recommendations, and I can sentence you within the maximum, within the guidelines, not under the maximum pursuant to the statute, but the maximum under the or within the guidelines, and that again would emphasize that.
Well, he also told the defendant what the maximum was on each count, did he not?
That's correct. But then he goes on to say he can be sentenced to the maximum within the guidelines. regarding the second issue. What we're looking here at here is an elements test, and it's the defendant's position that the attempt was a lesser included offense of the conspiracy, the way that these charges were alleged in the indictment. The discussion regarding whether or not attempt and conspiracy could have consecutive sentences focused on co-ed and inchoate offenses and substantive offense and conspiracy in the district court, but those were not the appropriate questions because an attempt is not a substantive offense and it's not a co-ed offense. It is an inchoate offense, the same as conspiracy is. Now, the defendant maintains that there was no waiver of this issue and that the standard of review here should be de novo because there was an argument that made in the court below which described the lesser included offense argument, although it didn't identify specifically as that. And relying on United States versus Stavros, if a statute can be violated in several different ways, then you have to examine or look to the allegations in the indictment. And although an overt act need not be a substantial step, in this case, they are. In conclusion, I would request that this court vacate the defendant's conviction and remand the case to the district court with directions to dismiss one count with prejudice and allow the defendant to withdraw his plea to the remaining count.
All right, thank you. Okay. Mr. Miller.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Eugene Miller. I'm an assistant U.S. attorney in the Central District of Illinois, and I represented the United States in the district court. The United States is asking this court to affirm both the judgment and sentence of the district court because no plain error occurred during the plea colloquy that affected the defendant's substantial rights and because consecutive sentences in this case did not violate the double jeopardy clause. Regarding the plea colloquy, in this case the defendant has to establish plain error because the defendant did not move to withdraw his guilty plea in the district court, did not object to the guilty plea in the district court. So he must show both that plain error existed and that that error affected his substantial rights. As we know in the brief in this case, the court did discuss a possible departure in this case. It did discuss it in the context of a downward departure during the almost hour plea colloquy. He discussed that he couldn't remember if the defendant had received a departure in his previous case. Also discussed whether there was a promise of a departure in this case. And also ascertained that no 5K1.1 downward departure was envisioned. And certainly implicit in those discussions with the defendant was the fact that the court did have the discretion under some circumstances to depart. The rule under Rule 11 simply requires that a defendant be informed of a possibility of departure, not necessarily upward or downward, but simply that the court had the opportunity under some circumstances to depart.
Didn't he say, though, that he would stay within the guidelines?
He did use the phrase within the guidelines. Yeah. He also used a separate phrase under the guidelines. And
that means the same thing, doesn't it?
Well, we believe that under and within in this case meant the same thing. It meant that he would be sentenced, the defendant, within the scope of the guidelines, under the guidelines, that he would apply the sentencing guidelines. He wasn't going
to... He doesn't give him a choice of applying the guidelines or not.
No, it doesn't, but he informed the defendant that he would, which I believe that Rule 11 requires him to defend, to inform the defendant.
Why would he have to inform him if it doesn't make any difference?
Well, Rule 11...
So that's saying I'm going to follow the law? Is that I'm making you the promise that I will not depart, I won't do anything illegal?
I believe that's right, and I believe that's what Rule 11 requires. It does require a district court to inform the defendant that he's required to follow the guidelines.
Well, isn't he supposed to tell him what the possibility is?
He's also supposed to inform them of the maximum possible sentences, which
right.
He did in this case. informed him that on count one you could get a maximum sentence of 5 years imprisonment, informed him that on count two you could also get a maximum 5 year sentence of imprisonment. He did, in this case, use the phrase within the guidelines. He never used the phrase within the applicable guideline range, and defense counsel mentioned that the prosecutor would be bound by that language, and the language we always use in a plea agreement would be, we will sentence, for example, at the low end of the applicable guideline range. That's the language used. The judge
would recommend.
Would recommend.
Had a little Freud in there, right?
Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you.
A lot of people think that's where the power is shifted, but you ought to be...
Absolutely.
Another branch of government.
Absolutely, Your Honor. That we would recommend that. And in this case, the court used the phrase within the guidelines and also used the phrase under the guidelines. And in fact, the quote that defense counsel just made, the court did not use the word within the guidelines. It actually there used under the guidelines. As we state in our brief, the court said, and you understand that at sentencing, I reject the recommendation of the government, I reject the recommendation of defense counsel, and within the guidelines, I sentence you to a maximum sentence under the guidelines, consecutive to your existing imprisonment, you would be able to appeal, but you cannot withdraw your plea of guilty. So the judge did use the terms under the guidelines, within the guidelines, interchangeably, to explain to the defendant that the court was bound to apply the sentencing guidelines. And he made that clear that he was not promising the defendant a specific sentence. It's detailed in the brief, but several times he made it clear that you're not promised an actual sentence, no one has promised you an actual sentence, no one has predicted what my actual sentence would be, and that the defendant could not expect an actual sentence. And it's for those reasons we believe there is no plain error, and that also ties into the fact that the defendant's substantial rights were not affected. In this case, the defendant showed up at court to plead guilty. There had been no promises by the government or the court at that time. So the claim that the court's promise induced him to plead guilty, certainly at the first point, doesn't hold water because, in fact, the defendant was there to plead guilty. Then, during the plea colloquy, the defendant...
Yeah, but the reason for the Rule 11 is so he has an opportunity to reflect on his decision to plead guilty and withdraw it if he doesn't like the consequences.
Absolutely, Your Honor. And in this case, as we said, we believe that...
Well, that's why the Rule 11 has to be so explicit.
Yes, Your Honor.
And the issue on this case is whether it was sufficiently explicit so that you can say with some degree of certainty he was stuck with his plea of guilty if he had known what the result would be.
I believe that's correct, Your Honor, and whether that affected his substantial rights. And in this case... To make it the question being one of the things under substantial rights is, would the defendant have pled guilty if there would have been a better plea colloquy, if it would have been more explicit, would he still have pled guilty? And we believe the evidence is overwhelming on this count. And the reason is, after the defendant pled guilty in this case, we look at the totality of the circumstances to make that determination. And after the defendant pled guilty in October, in December, a pre-sentence report that came out that gave notice that the court could depart, upwardly depart because of the defendant's 30 criminal history points for overstated criminal history. The government, the United States, then sent a letter in response to the pre-sentence report to indicate not only did we agree with that, we believe there were other grounds, his possession of a gun, his unwarranted downward departure in the previous case, that could also be grounds for an upward departure in this case. Certainly at that point, if the defendant had pled guilty based on a promise from the court that he could not, he would be sentenced within the range and there would be no upward departure, it would be appropriate to respond, that's not possible. The judge promised me a sentence within the guideline range, so therefore an upward departure is not possible. The defendant did not do that. In fact, he responded to the pre-sentence report by himself proposing a downward departure for himself. So clearly with that letter, he contemplated that the court could depart from the guideline range under certain circumstances. He demonstrated that by asking for a downward departure. Then, following that, the government filed a commentary in January where it laid out the basis for all the departures it was seeking. The defendant responded with the commentary, again, never raising the issue that somehow the court was stopped from departing upward because it had promised him some sentence within the guideline range. And then the sentencing hearing was held on January 17th. The defendant had an opportunity to address the court, indicated he had no objections other than the objections defense counsel had already lodged, none of which raised the plea colloquy as an issue, also an opportunity to allocute with the court. And then at the January 17th hearing, interestingly, the court found at that hearing that I agree with the probation officer in this case, the defendant is entitled to an upward departure, but the court didn't even impose sentence at that point. It found that he was entitled to an upward departure, but wanted an additional briefing on the consecutive sentences and other issues, and continued the sentencing to March 7th. So for 2 more months after the court told the defendant, I'm going to upwardly depart for overstated criminal history, I just have to figure out how much, the defendant had 2 months within the district court to move to withdraw his guilty plea if indeed the basis for his guilty plea was a promise that he was sentenced within the guideline range. The defendant did not do that, and that's strong evidence that, in fact, the defendant never expected in the district court that the court could not upwardly depart. He simply hoped the court would not, and then when he received the sentence he received, unhappy with the sentence, he has now brought this appeal. And the United States v. Vaughn Supreme Court case we cited actually has language in it that I believe applies in this case very similarly. It pointed out that it is important to have plain error review after sentencing on a motion to withdraw a guilty plea to separate out someone who has genuine second thoughts about pleading guilty versus someone who simply has sour grapes once the sentence is pronounced. And I believe that that is precisely the case that we're dealing with here, and therefore the court should affirm the judgment of the district court based on the Rule 11 colloquy.
Do you think an opinion along those lines ought to suggest that district judges use the term pursuant rather than under or within?
We would not object at all to the use of that term, Your Honor. The Rule 11 colloquy could have used more precise terms, but the question under plain error analysis is whether the error was plain and whether it affected the defendant's substantial rights, and we suggest that it did not. Second issue is whether consecutive sentences violate double jeopardy. Just briefly, we do believe that issue was waived by the defendant in the district court. The defense counsel specifically said to the district court, we're not saying it's double jeopardy. I don't believe that it could be any clearer as to its position on that. It did not argue double jeopardy. The defendant never cited the Blockberger case, which is the seminal case on double jeopardy in the district court, and the district court was never allowed to address this issue. If you review the court's order in finding that consecutive sentences were appropriate, it responded to the defendant's arguments. It responded to the argument that grouping rules prevented consecutive sentences, and it said they did not. It responded to a citation to a Third Circuit case that conflicted with the Seventh Circuit's Masters case, and it said the Seventh Circuit case was controlling, and it responded to the defendant's argument that 28 U.S.C. section 994 subpart L2. Oh, thank you, Your Honor. I see my time is up.
Thank you, Mr. Miller. Ms. Belasis?
Your Honor, with respect to the last point that counsel brought up, that was not the end of counsel's sentence. That this is not, I'm not making a double jeopardy argument. We're not saying it's double jeopardy or due process. Oh, wait, it is due process, and then he proceeds to further argue double jeopardy. And there's case law saying that these arguments, in order not to have waiver, you don't have to have an argument that's particularly articulate, as long as it is mentioned, it is brought up. And that was not the focus of counsel's argument, but he did make that argument. Also, within his other argument, he alludes to the fact that one case is subsumed in the other one, or one count is subsumed in the other one. So the defense position is that there was no waiver. And regarding the Rule 11 issue, counsel states that there was implicit discretion to depart. However, there is an explicit promise. I mean, the judge actually says, do you understand there's no promises that I'm making to you as to what your sentence will be other than it's within the guidelines. And when he used the term under the guidelines, it was in reference to the prior sentence. He said, you've been under the sentencing guidelines before, which you understand that pleading guilty here would change your offense level and possibly your criminal history category. So I think that is contrasted with the way he used under the sentencing guidelines is in contrast to how he used the term within the guidelines.
Our thanks to both counsel. Mr. Lasis, I'd like to extend an extra thanks to you for accepting this appointment and so ably representing Mr. Barker. The case is taken under advisement.